is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wahib, and here is what's coming up on a special pre-recorded show today, looking at the year 2020 and taking a peek at what's to come in 2021.
Key transitional government institutions have yet to be established, most important among which is a transitional National Legislative Assembly.
That's Nabil Biagio reporting on Sudan's democratic transition, details coming up. And we'll also look at what's to come in the U.S. relationships with African nations. All these and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. 2020 will always be known as the year of the pandemic. A year ago, officials in China said medical workers in the city of Wuhan had discovered a novel virus causing severe illness in many patients. The coronavirus, which causes the disease known as COVID-19, quickly spread around the world. And in March, the World Health Organization called COVID-19 a pandemic. More than 80 million people have been infected, and nearly 2 million have died from COVID-19 by late December. In recent weeks, new variants of the virus have been identified. Two in particular, one from Britain and one from South Africa, appear to allow the virus to spread more quickly. So far, the coronavirus has hit the African continent less severely than many other regions of the world. The World Health Organization says Africa has seen just under 2 million cases and about 40,000 deaths. In comparison, the United States has reported about 19 million cases and around 340,000 deaths, the most of any country. Still, the pandemic has overwhelmed some countries' medical systems and battered economies. And in recent weeks, the continent has seen rapidly spreading outbreaks in some region, with the African Centers for Disease Control warning the continent may be headed to a new surge in cases, much the way Europe and the Americas have. While the pandemic dominated world headlines, there was plenty of other news in African nations in 2020, including a number of national elections. The elections that happened in Africa this year in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic have had mixed consequences. From Johannesburg, Darren Taylor has more.
More than 20 African nations were slated to hold elections of some kind in 2020, but the coronavirus caused most to be disrupted and delayed. Some, such as Ethiopia's parliamentary polls, for example, were called off. Where voting happened, electoral commissions battled with tight budgets, the money diverted to battle COVID-19.
The second big impact that we saw was the closing of space, and that leads into the kind of political activities that we would associate with being the lifeblood of a democracy, you know, the kind of activities like...
Grant Masterson monitors governance around the continent for the Electoral Institute for Sustainable Democracy in Africa, based in Johannesburg.
Political rallies, association, meetings, protests, marches, etc. These are things that give energy to any democracy, and these are things that in 2020 were not only risky because of the pandemic, but in many countries were outright banned.
He says some administrations took unfair advantage of the pandemic.
And we saw a lot of political games being played with the banning of, say, opposition rallies, but ruling party rallies being permitted.
This is what happened in Tanzania in October. President John Magufuli's hand-picked electoral commission duly announced that he'd won a second term by a landslide. Masterson says there's been a real retreat from democracy in some parts of Africa, including Tanzania and Ivory Coast.
These are examples of countries where the political space really does seem to be very, very closed. Really, they're trending back more towards one-party authoritarian type of situations in those countries. So, a mixed
in Ivory Coast, also in October, Alassane Ouattara secured a third term with 94% of the vote. Opposition parties boycotted the election and declared the result invalid because of many irregularities. Coronavirus travel restrictions also meant international observers couldn't monitor most elections in Africa in 2020. Masterson says local observers try to fill the void.
They can't completely replace the type of international observations that we saw before. There's a huge difference between some citizen observer groups collectively observing the elections and, say, the African Union or a regional economic community like SADC or the EAC observing the elections.
He says the lack of comprehensive, independent oversight of polls was bad for Africa.
Certain things that were done during elections in 2020 most likely would not have taken place in the full glare of the world pre-coronavirus, pre-pandemic.
But I mean, examples are pre- and post-election actions by security forces in Guinea and Ivory Coast that left scores of people dead. But Masterson says there were also positive political developments in Africa in 2020. In Malawi, for example, the Constitutional Court nullified the result of the 2019 vote because of widespread irregularities. Fresh polls saw Lazarus Chakwera replace Peter Mutharika.
So we had, for the first time, an election overturned and a different result in the elections, which was very, very interesting. Certainly there's a lot of opinion on that one way or the other, but it was, I think, certainly a very, very significant moment in African electoral history.
Another significant consequence of the pandemic, says Masterson, is that it forced groups striving for a better Africa to cooperate like never before.
We saw a huge growth of webinars and seminars by very, very pro-democracy organizations putting their finger on a whole bunch of very important issues in 2020 that suddenly became accessible globally. That trend was coming, but what the pandemic has done is it's accelerated the embrace of that technology, and particularly...
Other analysts say this may result in more repressive regimes shutting down internet freedom in 2021. But for now, says Masterson, the increased connectivity is reason for optimism after a year in which that has been in very short supply. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
This year, we'll see more elections in several African nations. Among the first is in Uganda. In just a few weeks, Ugandans will head to the polls to elect their next president. Voter expectations are quite high, and many say they see a need for change. 10 candidates are challenging the incumbent Yoweri Museveni, who has led the country for 34 years. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Paul Seremba, a 32-year-old Ugandan who is among those hoping to see a change in Uganda's presidency after the January general elections.
I crave for change. I need change in our country because since we were born, we've lived to see one president over and over again. So we want to see how things can change when we change the leadership.
Seremba is optimistic one of the 10 candidates challenging President Yoweri Museveni will bring the change. The campaign message of Museveni's major challenger, Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, best known as Bobi Wine, is centered on change. Kyagulanyi has attracted huge numbers of followers, the majority of them youths, seeking change in government.
A vote for the National Unity Platform is a vote for democracy and the rule of law. A vote for equality and fairness. A vote for constitutional reform, where we shall fix and restore the term limit. It will be treason for anybody to try and change the constitution to extend their stay in power beyond the two presidential terms. A vote for the National Unity Platform is a vote for servant leadership. If you make me your president, I will not be your boss, I will be your servant.
Mugisha Muntu is the presidential candidate for the Opposition Alliance for National Transformation Party and once an ally of Museveni in the country's Bush War. In his campaign, however, he asks Ugandans to retire Museveni through the ballot.
Now, General Museveni had the option to retire voluntarily. He has missed out that. So, please, you yourselves, the owners of the country, retire him peacefully on 14th, and then a new president comes in.
Unlike his rivals who have published campaign manifestos, 24-year-old John Katumba, the youngest in the race, says once elected, his policies will be generated from the views of the voters.
I got my manifesto done, but I want also the Ugandans to engage in what will happen to this country. The greatest problem Ugandans are facing is poverty. Now, all Ugandans are very, very poor, and the rich are few. This poverty is caused to make Ugandans poor so that they can control over them. That's why I advise them to work with Katumba to overcome that.
The only woman in the race, Nancy Kalembe, has pledged to help youths out of poverty by turning their talents into job opportunities.
Uganda urgently needs a mother to help all the children of Uganda. We have all turned into beggars because we don't have jobs, we don't have factories, we don't have business. When I am president next year, we will be setting up talent development centers in every district in this country so that in those talent development centers, can turn your talent into a job where you can earn from. And this way we will reduce poverty and unemployment in this country.
However, Museveni is not yielding his office easily. He is traversing the country seeking re-election.
There is no opposition in Uganda which I cannot defeat because they have no logic. What are you opposing exactly? If there are some local mistakes, corruption and so on, those can be handled. We are against them also. So what is the opposition here based on? I don't see a group which has got a correct position in the politics of Uganda today that could defeat NRM.
Critics say Museveni increasingly represses dissent, but he remains popular with many Ugandans for the country's stability and economic gains. Sheila Asimwe, a sales executive in Kampala, says she will vote to re-elect Museveni because of the peace and security the country enjoys.
I have proof he has showed us. He has shown us that we have gotten security. We can move in the night. Trust me, together we go in bars and come back home like no one has stopped you on the way. That means there's security provided because people who are in the past, they tell us people wouldn't move in the night. But as we can move safely.
The other candidates in the race are Museveni's former security minister, Henry Tumukunde, Fred Mwesije, Norbert Mao, Patrick Amuriat, William Ayambala, and Joseph Kabuleta. The candidates are left with just a few weeks to convince about 17.7 million voters. Ugandans will go to the polls on 14th January. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
You're listening to a special pre-recorded New Year show on Africa News Tonight. I'm your host, Ihiyes Wuhib. In Sudan, citizens have been commemorating the second anniversary of the start of nationwide street protests that began on December 19th, 2018 and led to the overthrow of Sudan's longtime military ruler, Omar al-Bashir, in April 2019. The demonstrators will also protest recent political developments in the country and demand better living conditions. As we look at the Northeast African nation's transition to democracy, Sudanese analysts say the year 2020 has been tumultuous in the country with key successes and major challenges that will carry over into 2021. Nabil Biagio has this report from Washington.
Ismail Ibrahim is a professor at the Institute of African and Asian Studies at the University of Khartoum. He says Sudan's transition is faced with challenges, none more pressing than the economy.
The most pressing challenge, that is the living conditions of the people, you know. The rise in the poverty, level of poverty, the cost of living is just it's becoming terrible, unbearable. And unfortunately, it is related to the lack of the basic necessities, the food and cooking gas and all the oil necessary for the transportation, whether that's gasoline or benzene or whatsoever, you know, you call it, you know, the petroleum products, you know. And the most, I mean, disappointing thing that there is no prospect, there is of a constructive policy formulated by the government so that could improve the situation, you know, unfortunately.
Months of protest led the military to oust former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir after 30 years in power. The protests were led by the Forces of Freedom and Change, a coalition of political parties and professional associations which now shares power with the military. Ibrahim says a rift in the ruling coalition hampers Sudan's transition. Key transitional government institutions have yet to be established, most important among which is a transitional National Legislative Assembly. Since August 2019, Sudan has been governed by a military-civilian government. At the top is a sovereign council with 6 civilians and 5 military generals, and a civilian cabinet or council of ministers led by Prime Minister Abdul Hamdok. In this first half of a 39-month transitional period, the head of the Sovereign Council is General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, backed by General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who is in charge of a paramilitary force known as the Rapid Support Forces. Samah Salman is a strategic and economic analyst and president of the U.S. Educated Sudanese Association in Khartoum. She says central to the economic crisis is the control of the military and the rapid support forces over Sudan's economy.
Together, they control about 80% of the country's economy through a lot of the companies, both public and private companies. So you have the gold sector, the livestock and slaughterhouses, and petroleum. Most of these companies are actually owned by the military. And so unless the military agrees to give up control of most of Sudan's financial resources, they will continue to have the upper hand.
Sudan faces its worst food security crisis in recent history, caused in part by months of devastating floods, a COVID-19 lockdown, and hyperinflation. The United Nations says nearly a quarter of Sudan's population is severely food insecure, while the inflation rate hit 270% last month. Salman notes that Sudan's transition, however, has not been without successes. Key among them is a peace agreement signed in October between the government and a coalition of rebel groups. She says the government needs to work hard to bring on board holdout groups that have not signed the peace deal. Another success is that the United States dropped Sudan from its State Sponsors of Terrorism list, or SSTL, after 27 years.
Which is fantastic news. So it looks like things are going quite smoothly in this respect.
The move came after Sudan agreed to pay $335 million to compensate victims of terrorism attacks by Al-Qaeda in 1998 and 2000. Sudan was accused of providing support to the terrorist organization. Salman and others say Sudan also has taken important steps to expand civil rights in the country, preserve women's rights, and criminalize the practice of female genital mutilation. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
As a new year begins and a new American presidential administration prepares to take office, relations between the U.S. and Africa have never been more complex or potentially more promising. For a look at where things stand and what to expect with respect to American foreign policy towards the continent in terms of aid, security, and other matters, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with John Campbell, the Ralph Bunche Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Mr. Campbell, who was U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria between 2004 and 2007, began by stressing the continuity of relations between the United States and Africa over the past two decades, despite President Donald Trump's public pronouncement of substantial change.
The often fierce rhetoric from the president about making significant cuts in various programs that benefit Africa. Virtually none of them happen, largely because of bipartisan congressional opposition.
Which programs do you have in mind?
For example, Power Africa, an initiative of the Obama administration designed to increase the production of electricity in Africa, that has continued. The Young African Leadership Initiative, also an Obama program designed to groom young people for leadership positions in Africa, that has continued. And PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, a Bush initiative, has continued. And then President Trump's signature initiative with respect to Africa was designed to make American investment in Africa easier. That is just being rolled out now.
The truth is that for many Americans, Africa seems incredibly far off. In simple terms, can you explain why Americans should care about American policy toward Africa at all?
Well, let's start with demography. There are a great many Africans, and there are going to be a great many more of them in the relatively near future. Let's take a specific example. Nigeria at present has 205 million people. By mid-century, 30 years from now, it is anticipated that the population will exceed that of the United States and that it will be, in fact, the third largest country in the world by population. That should provide new markets and opportunities for investment and for general increase in economic links. Then let's move on to security, particularly in the Sahel and in West Africa. Jihadi groups are active, seeking to overthrow governments that are friendly to us. They're deeply hostile to the United States, and while they do not at present pose a threat to American security, they certainly pose a threat to American interests, and they may pose a threat to American security in the future.
And then there is the general movement toward democracy in Africa,
which Americans, almost all Americans, support and favor. Some African countries very much have a democratic trajectory that is positive. You put all that together, and we should be paying a great deal more attention to Africa than we have in the past, not as a matter of charity or assistance or aid, but simply because of our own interests.
What about American diplomacy toward Africa in the incoming Biden administration?
I find it interesting that President-elect Biden's choice for American ambassador to the UN, probably our most important diplomatic position, that he has tapped Linda Thomas Greenfield, a career diplomat who specialized in Africa and was ambassador to Liberia.
Of course, aid is a big part of America's policy toward the continent.
But I would caution here, the American economy is challenged. The incoming administration does not have as much money as I suspect many Africans assume it will have. I think in the shorter term, where the difference will be quite clear is in rhetoric and in atmosphere. There will certainly be an end to disparaging comments about Africa that have come out of the White House. I would expect that President Biden will visit Africa and that he will host African heads of state. These are matters of symbols, but symbols are extremely important.
John Campbell is the Ralph Bunche Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And that wraps up this special edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Barrow, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the interview.